Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, presented by Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman. Our thanks to Ollie Slack for the last hour. Now let's take a look at what we've got lined up today.
Well, we've a new feature. Laura Donoghue, three times runner-up of the Guild of Food Writers Blog Award, will be with us on alternate programmes with The Food Essay. Today, it's about apricots.
I was struggling with my camera, two bijou barquettes of raspberries, and a bottle of rosé from a small winemaker to drink with our last night's dinner. So Kitty took custody of the apricots.
Also today, we go foraging with Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester.
And nettles are absolutely everywhere, and they're all gone to seed now. So we don't use the leaves anymore, we now use the seeds. And they're absolutely wonderful. They're really, really, really tasty. Nice little superfood.
I've spoken to some of the cafe owners and workers in Mill Road to find out how the closure of the bridge has affected them.
All you can hear are my fridges running, which I'd like to shut them up as well, but it's just so nice and everyone's more relaxed.
I talk with Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern about food history and Cambridge's place in it.
So it's one of those desserts that really excite me. It's all about the ratio of caramel versus custard. And to think it was invented here in Cambridge and Trinity College just is really exciting. It's a bit of food heritage.
And as usual, we'll have details of free food that you can find in and around Cambridge. And at the end of the programme, we will have the local food news, including what jobs are available. Tequila!
But first, the Maypole Pub is in Portugal Place, hidden away behind the Park Street car park. It's very popular with townspeople and university people alike, and it's precious. It's an independent pub that has good food and a superb range of good beers. But its viability is under threat. On Thursday morning, I spoke with co-owner Vincent about the pub and what the threat to its livelihood is. He began by showing me a little of the pub's history, which is displayed on a timeline researched by his wife, which you can see above the back bar.
In 82, my family took over the pub. It was owned by Tolly Cobbold then. My father, Mario, and my mother, Christine, took over the running of the pub for the first time. Moving along to 2009, we were very fortunate, after having several owners and being tenants here, to be able to purchase the pub from Punch Taverns and make it our own business. So this made a massive difference to the way we could run the pub, what we could offer, and we've just been going from strength to strength since then.
Well, you're very popular, aren't you, with a good range of beers.
Thank you very much. Thank
Which
you.
Presumably was a bit more restricted in the days of Punch
It was
Taverns.
Very restricted. Well, Tolly Cobbold originally, we only had two real ales on. Yeah. We've moved up to 16 real ales from mainly local breweries and independent breweries. And we've got a lot more choice, yeah.
Right, but you're under threat.
Under threat, yes. So the proposed work for car park, which is...
So that's the Park Street car park.
The Park Street
next
car
door.
Park, yeah, which is we share a border with, actually. It abuts up to our property, especially our outside area, which is like incredibly popular in the summer and in the nicer weather. And also, we've got a lovely big canopy, so in the not-so-nice weather, so like today, a little bit rainy, but people will still be sitting out there having their dinner, enjoying a pint or a coffee. And the proposed work to the car park and the way it's being done puts our family and the future of the pub under massive threat.
Why is that? What will they do that will affect
your
trade?
What they'll do, it works on several levels. The first level is in the construction period. It's going to take around about 4 years to fully demolish the car park, dig down three levels to produce another car park underneath the apart hotel, and then to build up the apart hotel. So that's going to take a long time. And as you can imagine, having lunch next to a multi-storey car park being demolished is not an ideal option.
So very noisy, dusty.
Very noisy, very dangerous. So that's just one of the matters we have to contend with.
So from ground level upwards, the plan is for it to be a hotel?
It's going to be an apart hotel. I understand it's going to be leased to a company from the council. The council will own the the car park underneath, still as they do now, and that's going to be built by the people that are building the hotel.
Okay, and what can people do? I mean, you're a very valued pub, and it's slightly difficult for you because I know quite a number of students are amongst your clients, and they're not here to act on your behalf.
It's probably the worst time for plans to be submitted to planning permission because, as you know, Cambridge is a university town, and as you know, most university people aren't here at the moment. So that's quite a consideration. We started kind of raising awareness for the local residents and businesses around here very recently because the plans are being submitted. And we were very disturbed to realise that very few people knew that the plans were going to be submitted. And virtually no one has seen the plans apart from us in their changed state. So that was a big area of concern for us.
They've changed in what respect?
They've modified the plans, they've built up higher than they were originally going to do. They've changed the entrance to the car park. There's lots of things that are different to the original idea. And the original proposition, which was going to be a housing project in 2016, they were basing a lot of the plans. A lot of the ideas and plans were used from the 2016 idea, but that's completely changed.
Right. What can people do?
Well, they can go to their local council, to the city council. We've got the updated plans in the pub on display in our upstairs bar for everyone to see what they're letting themselves in for. They can ask more questions. They have to 21 days from, I think, today, to put in a formal kind of protest to it, and after that period they have no say.
Right, there isn't a petition running or anything?
Well, we've started it very late in the day. I mean, the project's been, it's only been going a short length of time and it's in its latest form, and I believe the developers were brought on board in about May time. So since May, the plans have changed several times. And one of the things I have been saying all along is, for such a massive scale project in such the city centre environment with loads of different considerations, it's a very short space of time to put plans together and consider the area.
Yeah. Would people writing to the local MP, Daniel Zeichner, be
worthwhile? I think that's a very good idea. We've got in touch with him ourselves. We're in touch with lots of people now. And we're trying to make all of our customers aware, and all the local media as well.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, Vincent.
Thank you very much.
We're on your side.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
The council's planning appeals page is on the web, and one of the several issues with the new development, besides the noise and potential danger of the construction, is the greatly increased danger caused by the large vehicles delivering to the pub no longer being able to turn at the car park, but having to reverse on a very narrow road past the local primary school, causing a potential danger and also much increased noise.
And people can go and see the plans for themselves in the pub. They can presumably talk with Vincent about how they can help.
Yes, and I hope people do. But as he said, many of the pub's customers are away in August, so will have no say because they're not aware of the issue. Not good.
Let's move on now to allotments. Now, the Cambridge Veg Fest has been running for the past week. It's been put on by Cambridge Sustainable Food to encourage us all to grow, cook, and eat more local seasonal veg. So see what you think of this next piece. It gives you just the briefest glimpse of the sheer variety of wonderful veg that's grown right here in Cambridge. And in this case, grown, picked, and cooked before an audience on the allotments.
We're going to do a bit of a double act, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to try. So what we've made is dictated by what's available. Eating locally and seasonally is one of the ways in which to reduce your carbon footprint, as well as getting some amazingly fresh vegetables and the health benefits that go with that. So what we've been able to source in the main is beetroot, potatoes, fennel, lots of herbs.
Some lovely greens,
yeah. Some chard, some elephant garlic, yeah. Which I think Alex is actually going to slice into.
Good luck, everyone.
Dave was a bit like, I'm not sure it's more ornamental than it is, but let's have a go.
We'll have a go.
What we're going to make with you today, some gnocchi with potatoes from Dave. With the gnocchi, Alex is going to do herb and fennel dressing and then some garlic greens.
Yeah, so we're going to use things like the fennel fronds, which often people don't use. We're going to use carrot tops. Basically, the side dish of greens, you could put any greens you want in there. Say the tops of the beetroot, for example, are also going in there as well.
Yep. The one thing about gnocchi is you can just make it with general purpose plain flour. It makes a much lighter gnocchi if you use 00 flour. That one's from Limoncello on Mill Road. It's just a finer grain to it.
Would you say a lot of cooking's more by feel, really, isn't it?
All my cooking's by feel. I'm hard pressed to give you a recipe for anything. In fact, there's a book out, and I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but it's about technique rather than recipes. And I had a flick through it when I was in the bookstore last. I think it's the way most people learn to cook. You know, how to make a sauce, what your bases are for different sauces, and build it up from there, which I think is pretty amazing. It's a really intuitive way of learning to cook. And then it's about adapting so that you don't fall into that thing where I've seen people just like, I can't make, I haven't got any courgettes, or I haven't got any aubergines. And you're like, yeah, it's December. You know, but actually the method you could use a squash, and it's about
knowing what you can substitute and what works well together.
Yeah. What was it called, Gemma? Do you remember?
Fat, heat, salt and
For those interested, that book is called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and it's by Samin Nosrat.
Yeah, and she's great. Should never do your shopping from a list of recipes.
Yeah.
You should go and look at what there is that is good and local and cheap, and then make up your recipes and your menus from there. I think maybe got it a bit the wrong way round these days. But luckily people are getting more and more interested in local food, which is great.
You can spend time. Winter's evening perfecting your Nokia technique.
Shall I go on to the greens?
Sure, yeah. Go for it. What is it? Is it garlic you can smell? Yeah. It's always garlic, isn't it?
I would eat spinach every day if I could get away with it. And also we're going to put the beetroot leaves in as well. It's one of the things that sort of people often, you know, well, you buy beetroots in the supermarket and it infuriates me because all the tops cut off.
Tops are gone,
And they're the best bits, like with the carrots as well. Lots of vegetables, like sort of brassica vegetables that come with big leaves like that, like cauliflower.
Yeah.
You can use cauliflower leaves. Quite often you can sort of deep fry them, make them nice and crispy, put them on top of things. So I would recommend not ever throwing away any leaves of anything. Also, I'm just going to chop up the stalks. You know, out of the beetroots today, we've used probably like 90% of the beetroot. Maybe, you know, that's the only bit that's going to get wasted. So the Sunday market's pretty good for stuff like this as well, isn't it? I've had some really nice chard from there.
So my routine with Sunday market is I go to Simon's first. So there's three main veg stores for me on the Sunday market. First one is Simon, so I go there. Simon is so cheap. It's Mayfield Organics.
It's amazingly cheap.
Amazingly cheap. Come away with carrier bags of your carrots, your potatoes, your onions, your leeks, your cauliflowers. Then I go round to
Wild Country Organics.
And then he always has all the really fine herbs, things like the courgettes. Very good salad, the courgettes with the flowers on, sort of more exotic stuff. So I top up there and then I go to the tomato people and I just go and buy pallets of tomatoes.
The most beautiful tomatoes you've ever seen.
What have you got up this way? You've got Ben Aveling's Radmore Farm Shop up this way, who has now started to do refills and loose dry store stuff.
This is the sauce for the gnocchi. So it's kind of like the beginnings of a pesto. It's just frying down the garlic, sticking in the fennel fronds, or whatever other greens you have, and then just stirring a few toasted pistachios through. Lemon juice and lemon zest as well.
Good, this was very nice.
It was.
Yeah, very, very good.
I haven't finished.
No, you enjoy yours.
Later that day, I headed over to Rock Road Allotments for another cooking session.
Trying to get more veg in our diets, we know it has a health benefit, but also we know that a lot of greenhouse gas emissions contributing to climate change are associated with meat and dairy. So what we're trying to do is inspire you to cook more veg at home, maybe get a plot of your own, grow some veg, and get more veg in your diets. So
I'm making burgers and chips.
Yeah, that's it.
Deep fried. Cue the inimitable Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern.
Thank you very much for coming, everyone. Now, I had an idea what I'd like to cook before I came here, and it's completely and utterly changed. When you have these wonderful ingredients in front of you, it's very difficult not to be completely inspired, especially the lovely broad beans, some lovely sprouting broccoli that's just flowering actually as well, which is wonderful. Some marge too as well, and I love these marge too. They're so crispy and fresh. So what I thought I'd do is just a dish where we just crush the broad beans and then we mix it with some olive oil, some cider vinegar and something for a bit of acidity. And I thought, oh, maybe put that rhubarb actually, because it's quite tart and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it tastes like one of those fruity vinegars raw anyway, so I thought I might bring it together a little bit. I thought we'd put it all together on a nice bit of grilled sourdough that's rubbed with some of this elephant garlic. It's the biggest garlic
absolutely
you've ever
enormous.
Seen. It's whacking, it's cracking.
We had some at the last session and the kids were just like, their eyes are popping out their heads. Is it stronger than normal garlic?
I find elephant garlic lighter. In fact, I was told it's part of the leek family.
Yeah,
well, I knew, yeah.
Obviously, no one else did.
No one else did. No, I absolutely did not know. Well, this is really a fancy beans on toast. Some onions and some garlic. And we'll start sweating that down in olive oil.
Sprinkle those out there.
And funny enough, if you put salt in onions when they start cooking, it makes them a little bit sweeter, which is really interesting, I always think. I'm going to add our beans to that. Right, pop our garlic in there as well. It's got a lot of natural sweetness in from the marge too, the broad beans. So we want to encourage the saltiness in the garlic rather than the sweetness. So you always have to put salt with it straight away. And there's two ways of really, the sweet flavour or the salty flavour. The salty flavour is to put salt with it straight away. Finely cut it, finely crush it or press it if you like. Oh, and then mix them with salt. That gives a savoury garlic flavour. But if you want a sweet garlic flavour, you could just drop your clove in whole like that and it'll give a sweeter garlic flavour. But you probably want to remove it afterwards. Unless you've got a vampire problem, then swallow it whole. So into this goes our broccoli and our marge too. Just for a second. Just to start the cooking off.
Oh, it's so pretty.
I'm a firm believer of not overcooking green vegetables.
Are you a fan of a broad bean at Parker's Tavern?
Gosh, the chefs are fed up with me at the moment because at Parker's Tavern there's broad beans on blooming everything.
Really?
But they're so lovely, and you know, we are as seasonal as we possibly can be and as local as we possibly can be. With broad beans being in season like they are right now, fantastic, it's just amazing. And this is the kind of thing I do at home. When I say that, I mean, I don't have a recipe and I don't know, and I change my mind quite often. Now, just keeping the shape of the rhubarb, but cutting it as thin as you possibly can. Only a little bit of this stuff because, you know, rhubarb is quite tart and quite acidic, but it really does remind me of raspberry vinegar. What grows together goes together. Everything growing here in this allotment, the proof's in the taste, isn't it? Right, so all those flavours are crushing into it now, but if everyone's going to taste it, I have to taste it as well, just to make sure it's good. It's fine. And there we are. That is the fanciest beans on toast you've ever seen. And do you know what the nice thing is? It'll be different next week. You come here, if you cook the same dish, you'll pick something different. Maybe the courgettes are a bit better. Maybe the broad beans haven't cropped so well that week. I would just like to say thank you very much all for coming at the Rock Allotments for picking up the most amazing, fabulous produce. And things like that are the reason I got into cooking in the first place. So it's just an absolute pleasure to come here and do that. Thank you very much.
Have a lovely taste.
And today is the finale of the year-long VegFest, culminating in a farmer's market, town meal and family fun day at the Museum of Technology down by the river near Cheddar's Lane. It's running till 4 p.m, it's all free. On Sunday, there's the Empty Common Community Garden Vegetable Creature Parade and Barbecue. Now that's on Brooklands Avenue from 2 till 5 p.m, and it's also free. And food aside, you know, I really loved how all the people involved in making these events, they were just having such a good time. The allotments that I recorded at, that went on all day, and the organisers rushed from allotment to allotment around the city so quickly. So do check out the various events they've got going on. Details are online at cambridgesustainablefood.org. And now, from the quiet of the allotments to the quiet of Mill Road, where Alan went on Tuesday. Alan?
There can't be anyone in Cambridge who doesn't know that the bridge in Mill Road closed at the beginning of July and will not reopen until the beginning of September. And there were plenty of predictions of hard times for traders as a result. I visited some of the cafes on the Romsey side of the bridge during the week to ask if the closure was affecting trading. Here are Steve from Limoncello, Angie from Relevant Records Cafe, Alex from Urban Larder, and Wesley from the Black Cat Cafe.
In general, I think it has had a negative impact on some of the traders. However, we do seem to be bucking the trend here a bit in so far as during the day we're quieter, but in the evenings where we have a sort of restaurant bistro, we've actually been busier.
Well, fortunately, the closure hasn't affected trade. In fact, the first week that the bridge was closed, we were noticeably busier.
What? Why?
I think people are coming to check out to see how much quieter the road is, particularly mums with little ones.
So these are sort of local people,
people
to Romsey,
that live,
probably.
Yeah, residents of Romsey. Yeah.
I think weekdays are like nice and calm, but then like last weekend it was very busy. We're just don't know where they came from.
The bridge is kind of shut off at times, so most people on this side decide to come to the cafes more because the ones on the other end are closed. But it's more quieter because, you know, other people who normally come from the other side of the bridge also can't come over, so they have to go all the way around and they'd rather stay on there.
Right, so it's become more local.
Yeah, pretty much. It feels way more local now.
Utility companies have been encouraged to take advantage of the much reduced traffic flow to do pipe laying and maintenance. So for a while there's been the noise from their pneumatic drills, and that's had a temporary effect. Here's Gusak from the Blue Sage Cafe.
A few days I closed earlier because no one coming. After they've gone from that, now it's much better.
And it really is much quieter in Mill Road. I wondered how much people were enjoying this quiet.
You've got the quality of life during the day. I mean, just
quieter.
Listen, all you can hear are my fridges running, which I'd like to shut them up as well, but it's just so nice and everyone's more relaxed.
It's lovely that there aren't buses and heavy goods vehicles going up and down. That's the treat. It's been a bit noisy with the gas works at the weekend, but it's nice and calm outside there today.
Steve from Limoncello and Angie from Relevant Records there. So, would people like the bridge to remain shut? Here's Angie again, followed by Alex from Urban Larder.
Yes, yeah, it's much preferable. I mean, customers are all complaining about the noise, but then actually when it's quiet like this, when the road is quieter, the customer's happier.
Yeah, and it's more relaxed, I guess.
Yeah, more relaxed.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah. It'd be a lot nicer, because obviously, like, us trying to get to work as well has, like, affected us, but it would be nice to see people from the other side as well.
When I recorded that on Tuesday, not even pedestrians were using the bridge because of the dreadful fire on the town side of Mill Road, so it was probably even quieter than usual, and then there was a very nice relaxed atmosphere. But now we're going to get even more relaxed and slow right down to enjoy our new feature. It's by Laura Donoghue, the highly regarded food writer, photographer and cook who lives in South Cambridgeshire. Laura was born in Texas and moved to New Jersey as a child and then as an adult to California via New England and Denmark. And there she lived in Berkeley and worked at Alice Waters Chez Panisse. Later, she settled in the UK, where she has lived almost as long as in her home country. Laura has been a finalist for the Guild of Food Writers Food Blog of the Year Award 3 times for her blog Crumbs on the Table, which features her best recipes and stories about how food gets to our tables. And now you can hear Laura on alternate editions of Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Her first essay is about apricots.
In search of the honest apricot. I'll go back to the beginning. I remember sitting on the back steps under a punitive August sun, basting a rock, pretending it was a roast. I was 3. We were visiting my mother's family in rural Texas after a long drive through heat mirage and tumbleweed. It was a permanently hot, thirsty place. Drinking water had to be pumped by hand into a bucket, and I was afraid of the ladle with its spot of rust. I don't know for sure if I could see the apricot tree from those blistering steps, but that's how I remember it, as the only green thing in view whose fruits enchanted me. I was astonished that the things familiar as something I loved to eat were joined to this other thing I knew as a tree. It was an epiphany, the connection between the one and the other. How could this be? It must be magic. Decades later, apricots capture a primal joy for me that comes from that first wonder at the generosity of things that grow. It's the most ravishing fruit when it's honest, and the most disappointing when it's not. And it makes me actually angry to see those hard, pale rocks in our shops, knowing what they could have been. I've been chasing the ideal apricot all my life, but it's proved the most elusive of fruits. It's one of the worst casualties of what I think of as the great fruit con, where so much looks like it should, but tastes of so little. Commercial varieties of fruit are typically bred to grow fast and prolific, and picked far from ripe so they can stand up to mechanized processing, transport, and storage. The industrialization of our food supply has changed the flavor of much of what we eat, from tomatoes to strawberries to apricots. A few years back, I happened to be in the right place at the right time to remind myself of what a real apricot tastes like in season, where it's grown. My sister and I had a rendezvous in Montpellier, France, in the southeastern corner of the country, where it's hot enough for palm trees, which tells you something about what apricots need. The season began during our stay, and we glutted ourselves from the markets that had varieties on display from different parts of the country. Some were smaller and redder than others. These seemed the most intense, if not the juiciest. Some rounder and more moist. We had repeated taste tests and were undecided. They were all glorious, the textures just right, not mealy or mushy if you chose well, sweet but not too, and so fragrant with all that sun. More than once during these feasts, we'd recall a story our parents tell of a journey they'd taken in their younger days to Bryce Canyon in southwestern Utah. They'd driven all day through otherworldly landscapes, arriving hungry after dark at the one-horse town where they were to spend the night outside the national park. Everything on the single street had shut tight except for the bakery, which was still sweeping up. They chanced it, hoping for something, anything, to find there was one last thing left on the baker's shelves. A single golden-crusted apricot pie. They bought that whole pie and brought it back to their room, where they ate it with plastic forks, sitting on the bed, drinking motel coffee. And they raved and gave thanks and demolished that pie like it was the first and last pie created in heaven to set the example for all pies on earth. Close to the end of our stay in Montpellier, Kitty and I visited a farmer's market under the ancient aqueduct, and there we found a stall dedicated to apricots, mounds of them, sold by the people who grew them 6 miles outside Montpellier. These were voluptuous larger fruits, very ripe, perfect at that moment. They were sold by the kilo in slatted wooden baskets by people with stained hands and worn t-shirts who seemed anxious to sell. This was their livelihood, and it would be a bad day if they had to load those apricots back onto the truck to take home again. Despite our impending departure next day, I bought a greedy basket, not realizing it weighed over 2 kilos, until I'd negotiated payment with my halting French. I was struggling with my camera, 2 bijou barquettes of raspberries, and a bottle of rosé from a small winemaker to drink with our last night's dinner. So Kitty took custody of the apricots. We ended up walking for another few hours in the beating sun, having stumbled across a food festival in the park with white-hatted chefs displaying their wares under white tents to gentlemen in summer suits and ladies in pretty frocks. By the time we'd been waylaid by that genteel spectacle and a glacé stand, I think even Kitty felt the weight of apricots as this side of burdensome. While she flew back to the States next day, I got my apricots home to England in my carry-on, wrapped individually in tissue, protected with a fortress fashioned from cardboard scraps. They made it better than hoped. Those in best shape were eaten au naturel. The ones that arrived a little sore for their travels were turned into jam according to plan. The jam gods were with me. It was a perfect batch. It was, of course, sublime fruit, so I could have done almost anything and it would have been beautiful. But I'm sure it was also to do with the memories that kept me company as I made it. The thought of those who had grown the apricots and picked them and hauled them to market, the gratitude to Kitty for toting them on her back all day, the mental picture I carry with me of that first childhood tree that started my love affair with apricots and all things that grow. And of course, the anticipation of how good that jam would taste on a proper baguette with real butter. The little meal I think I'd choose over any other for my last on earth. Three precious jars came from this endeavor. They arrived courtesy of the post a few days later with Kitty in North Carolina and with family assembled in California. And everyone's appreciation was all I and the orchard could wish for. That encounter in Montpellier brought me so close to the apricot, but I never did find the trees. I left France yearning to see the fruits growing again and vowed someday to go back and look for them. So imagine my astonishment when, quite by accident, I discovered one more recent summer, right here in rural Cambridgeshire, a small family fruit farm that grows apricots virtually in my own backyard. I'd gone to Willingham, north of Cambridge City, on a search for the Manning family farm, where I'd been told I could find heritage variety plums. When I walked through the doors of the Bushel Box Farm shop, the unmistakable perfume of ripe apricots stopped me in my tracks. There they were in full proud view. And yes, they were grown right there on the farm, along with the plums. I couldn't believe my eyes. I bought 6 varieties of plum that day, and almost every apricot they had on display, my conscience just stopping me from taking the lot so other people could have some too and spread the word. So I went back again, and a third time, and I made jam and tarts and my mom and dad's pie, and we ate them fresh every day for the few weeks of their season. Being able to taste an apricot, where it's grown, when it's been allowed to ripen on the tree, is a rare thing anywhere and will spoil you for life. You'll forever know the difference and never again be content with pale imposters. Growers who give us this experience do an invaluable service in retaining and rehabilitating our appreciation of flavor and the collective taste memory we have as a culture that may, if we continue to value it, help us hang on to fruit that tastes like it should. They preserve old varieties despite the fact they don't produce bumper crops or are susceptible to frosts or disease because they value them for their flavor, for the heritage, and their genetic diversity. 3/4 of edible plants have been lost globally over the past century. We're overly reliant on too few varieties, which have become increasingly inbred and therefore vulnerable. The sacrifice of taste may seem frivolous compared to the need to feed a growing population, but flavor doesn't have to be at odds with commercial realities. It's only been so because large-scale agriculture has focused on breeding varieties for yield and transport and storage. Some plant breeders are starting to look more at flavor these days, as well as crop resilience to changing climates, at least for some of the major commercial crops. In some cases, going back to older varieties and even wild ancestors. This makes it possible to select traits from a much greater diversity of genetic material and develop varieties that could have both flavor and the qualities our modern food system needs. The Manning daughter, Wendy, tells me there will be no apricot harvest on the farm this year. The April frosts took the blossom. Apricots flower early, so they're always at risk. She hates to tell her customers this because she knows how much we look forward to them, but she's philosophical. There's always something to challenge the fruit grower, and this season it's a combination of last summer's intense heat, putting the trees under pressure, a wet winter, and spring's repeated cold snaps. The apples and pears that are to follow in autumn will have their own challenges from this growing season, too, here in Cambridgeshire and all around the country. Growers are always at the mercy of the elements and in the front line of unpredictable climate extremes, which makes special crops like apricots all the more so when we can get them. Even what we may think of as ordinary crops can't be taken for granted. It's been like this throughout human history, as long as we've been cultivating what we eat. And yet, as we know, we're entering a new age of climate uncertainty and are told to expect more of these extremes. Maybe the fact apricots can be grown in Cambridgeshire at all is partly down to these changes. I've found my apricot trees at last, and I see them as part of our fragile environment, which is so dependent on us, as we are on it. The magic of things that grow seems even more miraculous when we think of how rare it is that we get to experience eating something with this kind of honesty, this immediacy. If you visit Windy and Willingham this summer, you can find a selection of beautiful plums, though their harvest is patchy this year too, some varieties producing as usual, some not so much. The varieties change every week as some peak and some go over and some come in. Get to know everyone you can. And next year, maybe, hopefully, there will be apricots again.
And that was Laura Donoghue. And having picked and eaten a ripe apricot fresh from the tree in Provence myself, I completely understand Laura's reference for the fruit. You can find her blog at crumbsonthetable.co.uk. Laura will be back here on Flavour on the 17th of August.
Well, we've had a period of hot weather, a bit of rain too, so vegetation is growing well. And it's a good time to do a spot of foraging with Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester, beginning in the Green Man Garden.
So what we're going to talk about today actually is all the things we use that aren't ripe at the moment. So what we're going to go for first is, well, we're sitting right underneath it now, is the lovely elder. So at the moment, as you can see, all the flowers are gone, or they're just dying out. And we've got the start of the green berries that are starting to look lovely and plump now, but they're not ripe and not black. So what we do with them at the moment is we take them down, we spend hours with a fork getting the berries off, and we put them into brine and leave them for a couple of months, and then they are absolutely wonderful wild food capers.
And I'm sure I've seen in some of my older recipe books recipes for these. We've forgotten about it, haven't we?
Yeah, it's not used as much anymore, but they really are a lovely way of getting flavour across. Use exactly the same way as capers. Go great with fish.
And can you do anything other than brining them?
We don't tend to, but yeah, you could do. They're quite gritty if you weren't to brine them, so I probably wouldn't recommend doing much else other than brining or pickling. I'd wait until they get ripe after that.
Right, what should we go and have a look at next?
So the next thing we're going to look at is one of our smaller plum trees down here as well, which we do a very, very similar thing. Because we've got quite a few plum trees, we leave most of them to go ripe, and then we make jams and preserves and as many different things, ketchups, as we can possibly do, because you get kilos of them. But one of the smaller trees, we've just taken all of the unripe plums off. So we wait until they get to the full size, but then they haven't ripened up yet. And again, with these, we sit there, we prick them, and then we put them in brine, and we leave them for 2 months as well. They come out with this wonderful flavour at the end. They're still very much a plum, but you get almost this olive quality to them as well from the brine. So the salty, slightly tartar, firm plum.
With a stone in, presumably.
With a stone in, yeah, but we can cut around that afterwards. And if you follow us on social media, we did a dish a couple of weeks ago with a tapenade made out of the unripe plums. They were the ones left over from last year still, so.
And do you have to sterilise things at all?
Yes, everything like that is important that you sterilise, obviously. So through the dishwasher, in a dry oven on a low heat, you're trying to bring it up to a temperature above which.
So that's for the jars,
bacteria
or that's
survive.
For the plums?
That's for
what?
The jars. The plums you just give a wash. Mm-hmm. The salt and everything like that in the brine is going to make sure that it's an inhospitable
environment.
Yes. Yes.
Right, so we've got plums, we've got the unripe elderberries. What else? What other treats are there?
And the final thing at the moment that we've got growing around the garden is walnuts.
Ah.
And it's a little bit later this year. Normally you'd want the end of June, really early July, to kind of catch them. And you're looking for being able to get a pin straight through them at the moment. You don't want the shell to have formed. Ah. And what we're going to make is, what I definitely like with some cheese at Christmas is pickled walnuts.
Oh, yes, so do I. Yes.
They're one of my absolute favourites. So all we're looking for is basically the walnuts. They will be a little bit smaller than normal, but before the nut has formed.
They're the ones that go incredibly black.
They do, yes. You want to wear gloves for pretty much this whole process. Ah. Picking you can get away without, but certainly for... So after we've picked them, we'll then sit there and we'll top and tail them, get them nice and neat. You definitely want gloves on for this point.
Okay.
Because they'll leak a lovely yellow liquid all over your hands, which will go jet black, and you will not get out for days.
Must have been used for dyeing in the past then, mustn't it?
Yes, they have, definitely, yeah.
Ah, right, fascinating. Shall we take a little walk down to the meadows now?
Yep, certainly.
So I'm still with Teeth Thompson, but we've now walked through the garden of the Green Man in Grantchester, and we're now out in Grantchester Meadows, and it's the most beautiful sunny day. What have we got here, Steve?
Right, so the first thing we come across is the nettles, and nettles are absolutely everywhere, and they're all gone to seed now. So we don't use the leaves anymore, we now use the seeds, and they're absolutely wonderful. They're really, really, really tasty, nice little superfood. So what you want is the green seeds.
Yeah, they're pick tiny.
Them. They are, they're really nice and small. You pick them and you rub them between your fingers.
Yeah.
And that releases all the seeds. Then you can either dry them on the windowsill, or you can just have them fresh as a little snack while you're walking.
Oh, can I taste?
Yes, certainly.
Mm. They're slightly nutty.
Yeah.
My goodness. I've seen so many nettles with so many nettle seeds on them. I never knew you could eat them. That's fantastic.
A teaspoon a day of them on your granola is really good for you. Helps flush everything through. You don't want to eat too much of them, though. I wouldn't go much more than a teaspoon of that, because otherwise I'll start to have adverse effects.
Oh, really?
Nothing damaging, but...
Good, fair enough.
Just won't be as good for you.
And there's certainly enough nettles I can see around here, little crickets, and very happy. So is there anything else much now?
At the moment, the next thing we're waiting for, really, is the berries to start coming through, down on Grantchester Meadows anyway. So we've got the hawthorn that are starting to green up. There's going to be a couple of months still. We've got the blackberries that are just starting to come through. We get a couple of weeks of sunshine, we might get lucky, start to get them. The beginning of season ones are always much, much, much tarter, so we can use them for different things.
For blackberries,
yep, for blackberries, yep. Mm-hmm. And then as they start to get further into the season, they start to sweeten up a lot more, and they'll be nice. Down the other end of the meadows, we've got some lovely mushrooms starting to grow up on the trees. We've got a lovely chicken of the woods.
What does that look like?
It's a polypore mushroom, basically. It's a bright orange colours shelf bracket on a tree. It gets its name because it has the smell of cooked chicken, texture of it. It's a really nice mushroom, really, really easy to identify. Can't really go... Well, you can always go wrong.
With mushrooms, yes.
But you can't really go wrong with this. You'll be amazed at things I've seen people confuse, but chicken of the woods is a very hard one to do that with.
That's a lovely... So how have you gained all this knowledge? Is it reading? Is it the internet? How do you know all this?
A lot of it was through, because I've been doing this for 10-12 years now, a lot of it was through just being inquisitive when I was younger. So a lot of things, like growing up in a little tiny village, you learn a lot of these things just generally growing up, but also reading books on the internet, talking to other people. The wonderful thing about going out and picking your own food is there's always somebody who knows something you don't. Whether it's somebody who knows absolutely, thinks they know absolutely nothing, say, they might know a plant that you don't know. You can go in, always do your research. So I always have my key identification books I always confirm something with. But
yes, but I mean, there's things like nettles. You can't mistake a nettle, can you?
Exactly. Just built up over years.
And what about nuts? We're a bit early for sort of nuts and seeds, leaf tree seeds, aren't we now?
A tiny bit, probably in about a week or so, maybe 2 weeks, I'll start picking the hazelnuts. We'll pick them green. You don't really want to wait for them to ripen up on the tree, because you ain't going to beat the squirrels.
Exactly.
It's just not going to happen. So we will pick them green, but then you can leave them to ripen up on your windowsill at home. They will start to form the nut then.
Because again, we've got a tree, squirrels tend to look evilly at it, and I've never beaten the squirrels. So.
No, it's not worth trying. Pick them green. You can also use them green. They're perfectly edible then, and it's got a very different flavour. It won't get that intense nuttiness that you get from the normal hazel if you eat them green.
Would you do anything with them, or just eat them, have them on the side?
We tend to, if we're doing them green, we tend to blend them and make almost like a butter thing with them. So like peanut butter, say, or something like that. Works very nicely.
And I suppose you could do a pesto type thing with
them? Yes, exactly, yeah. Anything like that. I wouldn't bother roasting them off if you're having them green, though. It's not the same.
Even though it's sort of almost the height of summer, there's still enough in the meadows to eat and a lot more to look forward to in the autumn.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Steve.
No problem.
That was Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester with his monthly foraging tips. And Steve will be back on the 17th of August.
And he is incredibly knowledgeable. I'd never heard of eating nettle seeds before, and I've read lots of books about this sort of thing.
They were tasty.
Impressive. I'm free. I'm free. And there's another source of free food available now in Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yes, of course, Olio is the free-to-download app on iOS, Android phones and tablets. And using your location, it will tell you the free food that is nearest to you. Now, this food, it's donated by anybody and everybody all around the city and beyond with the idea of preventing food that's close to spoiling or just preventing unwanted food from going to waste. This is well worth a try, and it's worth being part of a growing community, of course, of free food.
And a reminder that some food outlets sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close, at very reasonable prices, using the Too Good To Miss app. In Cambridge, they include Cambridge Oven in Hills Road, Yo Sushi in Petit Curie, Harriet's Tea Rooms in Green Lane, Bennett's Cafe in King's Parade, Little Petra on Mill Road, and Cafe Bread and Butter in Milton Road. Now, Cambridge has an important place in food history, partly because of Trinity Burnt Cream. I admired one at Parker's Tavern with Tristan Welch, who talked about it and other aspects of food history.
It's one of those desserts that really excite me. It's all about the ratio of caramel versus custard. And to think it was invented here in Cambridge and Trinity College just is really exciting. It's a bit of food heritage.
But the French might say it's theirs.
Yeah, I love a bit of controversy, and I'm happy to agree to disagree with the French. A cultural history of gastronomic heights, the least they could do is just give us one little creme brulee, you know?
Exactly.
One little creme brulee.
Yes, and call it Trinity Burnt Cream.
Yeah, exactly. Come on. But actually, I do like to wind up some of our French employees a little bit, and it's all light-hearted and good fun, actually.
You've got a recipe for it dating back to 1740. What book was that in? Is this one of your collection?
Gosh, I can't remember. I would have to go back and look. I do have an antique book collection. It's been a real passion of mine for so long, because I always think to look forward you have to look back, and I always find it so exciting to see what was cooked and all that sort of stuff. Pre-Victorian era, and actually when the Victorians streamlined it as well, was really interesting as well on that. But yes, yeah, it's a real passion of mine.
Yeah, it's a passion of mine too.
Well, no, do you know what? I think you're way more qualified than me. I'm just a mild voyeur of the world of food history.
So, how big is your food history book collection?
Oh, it's three bookcases.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it started from a young age, actually. I remember the antique cookbook shops in North Norfolk. They're still there, but they're way more expensive now than they used to be. So for 20 pence, I could get an antique cookbook. For a quid, they'd give me six, you know. So I got really excited. And then just as time went on, I would collect from relatives and things like that. You know, I find Mrs. Beaton's really interesting. And I love that sort of, that series that kind of gave a bit of history of Mrs. Beaton as well, and it explained a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
But also, you know, things like British recipes for macaroni and macaroni pie. We were great importers and all this sort of stuff. Very, very exciting. And in fact, Duke of Cambridge tart as well.
Yes.
Now, if I saw you on your website, I believe, a bit about Duke of Cambridge tart, and that inspired me to recreate Duke of Cambridge tart here.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. I like to joke that Duke of Cambridge tart was predates Bakewell tart, right? Is
yes,
that what
you said? Yes. So you always sort of adjust a recipe to suit modern taste, would you say?
I think we have to move with modern times. I think it's really, really important to. I think that's how a lot of these recipes came about in the first place, adapting to modern times. So what I've done here with the Cambridge Burnt Cream is just adapted it to the modern time a little bit. I like the cold, unctuous, luxurious flavour of a good set cream, and that has to be really creamy. However, I do struggle a little bit with the ratio of caramel to custard in some dishes and all this sort of stuff. So what we've done the caramel separate to the custard, and we've gone with a lot more caramel because I wanted a really, really rich custard. So those two things really balance each other out. It's all about the ratio of bitterness versus luxurious unctuousness.
Yes, I would totally agree. It looks like an amazing sort of caramel top hat.
But what we don't do is, as history would say, is take the crest of Trinity and press it into the yes. and caramelise it on the top. We don't do that because, we're not Trinity College.
No.
And do you know what I love about Cambridge Burnt Cream is the beautiful crunch. Do you want to hear it?
Ooh, yes.
Should we hear a crunch?
Go on. Yes.
We get it. Now, that is satisfying, isn't it?
Wow. And it is splintered perfectly.
It's wow. Well, food's got to be fun as well. And I think that's a big part of the fun.
I mean, one of the things you seem to do the most Cambridge twist on here was with the afternoon tea.
Yes. Our afternoon tea follows little historic anecdotes, if you like, stories of Cambridge, ranging from the rules of football that were written out here on Parker's Piece, right the way through to the history of boat rowing and the races, the famous Cambridge-Oxford boat race. Even in our espresso cup, there's a little Oxford boat sinking.
I had not noticed that.
So there's a bit of comedy and a bit of fun about everything. Yeah, I think it's very, very important.
Have you ever done grassy corner pudding? Have you come across that
no.
one? Oh, I will get you the recipe.
Dr. Bailey, tell me more.
It's the one that was always served as part of the bumps. So, yeah, but has jelly in it. So.
But bumps as in the birthday bumps?
Bumps as in the bumps. The bumps, the races.
Grassy pudding was served there. Oh, I'd love to know more.
I will find out more and send
I'm
it
intrigued.
To you.
Yes, well, that's another show right there.
Yes. Why is it called Parker's Tavern?
Good question. Well, I definitely didn't want to lose the history and association with the park. I think that's really, really important. But what I love as well is, I believe, Parker's Piece was named after Edward Parker, which was a very famous cook of the colleges back in the days that grazed his cattle on Parker's Piece. So there's a chefy element to it as well, which I kind of like. And the idea is we wanted a relaxed, informal eatery or restaurant that doesn't promote stiffness and all that sort of stuff, but is a restaurant of high quality. And I thought if we named it Tavern, that would probably bring it in to line, because we've got a history here of we are a coaching inn. We've got a great history of coaching inn. So a tavern is what it would have been many years ago.
It's very much like the Woolsey in the sense of the sort of charm of the style, and come here any time and enjoy.
Exactly. Hopefully. Oh, it's supposed to be just be a fun place.
Oh, it's an amazing place. Absolutely love it. Have you ever written a cookery book? Or are you thinking of writing a cookery book? I know you've contributed to recipe books, but is there a top secret thing going on here?
Well, you never know. You never know. Watch this space. Cookery books take a while to write, but we're thinking about it. We're toying with it. It would be wonderful.
I think that would be absolutely perfect and would suit it and yourself just down to the ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be amazing.
I think it'd be great souvenirs. But we'll see. Watch this space.
That was Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern. And yes, we will certainly watch this space. Exciting.
Green Onion signalling the start of our new section there, and we begin with jobs.
And plenty of jobs available on the Romsey side of the Mill Road Bridge. Bravo Patisserie want waitresses, or presumably waiters.
The Black Cat Cafe needs staff, full or part-time. Apply in person or send your CV to blackcatcafecambridge.co.uk.
Lutayo, the music restaurant, is looking for colleagues to join them, but you must be able to speak and write both English and Chinese. You can apply in person at the restaurant.
And lots of jobs away from Mill Road too. The Ivory Brasserie in Trinity Street is looking for a sous chef, a chef de partie and a commis chef. Apply via the company's website, where you can find further details.
The Blue Line in Hardwick Street wants a full-time chef de partie. For details, phone James on Cambridge 789593.
A full-time chef de partie is needed at the Trinity in Trinity Street. You can phone Cambridge 322 130 for details.
And if you're applying for any of these positions, good luck. And please say you heard about the job on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And if you have a vacancy you'd like to advertise in this slot, please email sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
Some other news now. At Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road this Thursday, Steak and Honour are in attendance, and on Friday it's Dining with Dario, who will have some Italian fish dishes and seafood dishes, such as calamari and some risottos. On the 7th of August, there will be a wine tasting tour of southern France with Steve Hovington of the Cambridge Wine Academy. Now that's also taking place in the Cherry Hinton Road and begins at 7:15 for 7:30. The cost is £22.50. That includes bread, cheese and cured meats.
On the 3rd of August at the Cambridge University Botanic Garden, from 10 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon, there's a talk on the nightshade family, one of the most interesting plant families, and it includes potatoes, chilies and tomatoes, and also deadly nightshade and the legendary mandrake. Entry to the talk is free, and it's suitable for children too, but adults will need to pay the usual garden admission charge.
Looking further ahead, on 14th of September at Cambridge Cookery and Bistro in Purbeck Street, off Hills Road, it's Inder's Kitchen. There'll be a plethora of buffet-style dishes in the wine bar from 6:30 onwards. Booking is essential.
And finally, looking even further ahead, journalist and broadcaster Gavin Essler is giving a talk under the auspices of the Cambridge Literary Festival. That's on the 23rd of October. It's called Brexit Without the Bullshit and will include its impact on food and drink. It's in the McCrum Lecture Theatre off Bennett Street from 6:30 to 7:30. The cost is £13.
And that's all we have time for today. We're here on alternate Saturdays at 1pm, repeated on Sunday at 2pm, and on podcast too. Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today,
at 2 o'clock, Women Making Waves with Linda Ness and Susie Thorpe. From 3 till 4, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 4 till 5, What You Might Have Missed, the best of Cambridge 105 in the last 7 days. 5 until 6, Stage and Screen with Ashley Capaldi. 6 until 8, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance Show. From 8 until 9, Centuries of Sound. 9 till 11, Paul Cristoforo with Rock of Ages. And 11 till 1 in the morning, Club Beats. But that's all from us. We'll be back on the 3rd of August. But until then, goodbye.